as a user on Spotify.
Hello and welcome to Final Draft. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, and a big welcome wherever you are listening, in your car, on your phone, as you run, as you walk. It is great to be joining you with the best new Australian books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, and of course that is what Final Draft is all about. It is our summer session, but with a little bit of help from our friends, we are very fortunate to continue bringing you new incredible releases from the latter part of 2021. As we get started, it is very important to acknowledge that 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, that I am recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. And we acknowledge this to pay respect to the traditional owners of those lands and to just remind ourselves that this is unceded land, that it's stolen land, that treaty has not been made in Australia, and that means that there is so much work to be done. Now, today on the show, I'm joined by another fantastic 2SER book brain, Felix Shannon from Death of the Reader. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that in just a sec, but I've been noticing our end-of-year favourite lists from 2021 are kind of, they're starting to dry up, but the up-and-coming 2022 book lists are here, and there is some incredible stuff to look forward to. I mean, just coming up in the short term, Omar Saker, the incredible poet, author of The Lost Arabs, he's got his debut novel, Son of Sin, coming up. I cannot wait to read that. There is new stuff coming out from Toni Jordan, who has graced us with her presence many times on the show and is always a pleasure to read. There's Geraldine Brooks has got a new novel coming out. Mirandi Riwo has another short story collection. She's a terrific short story writer. Many of us will be familiar with Stone Sky Cold Mountain. What else have we got coming up? Claire G. Coleman has a new speculative fiction novel coming out. I've been reading Lies, Damned Lies over the summer break, and it is absolutely searing. A searing indictment on the way the colony operates against First Nations people. Chris Flynn has got a new collection coming out. J.P. Pomari has a new thriller. And, I mean, isn't that just, you know, something to look forward to? And finally, Robbie Arnott's new novels from Robbie are just always a great joy. So just a few things to look forward to coming up this year. I'm going to do my best to bring them all to you. But for today, I have got Felix Shannon, and he is bringing in the debut novel from Michael Burge. It is called Tank Water, about a man returning to the small town where he grew up on the death of his cousin and coming to terms with the past. So after this short break, Felix Shannon is bringing us an interview with Michael Burge on Tankwater.
Don't miss Flickerfest, Australia's leading Academy qualifying short film festival this summer. Catch the world's most provocative and wildly entertaining short films across 10 jam-packed days. Flickerfest's 31st International Short Film Festival is happening at Bondi Beach from January 21 to 30. For tickets and festival info, visit flickerfest.com.au. Flickerfest, a kaleidoscopic carnival of short films. Flickerfest sponsors 2SER.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It is Final Draft time, books, writing and literary culture. My name is Andrew Popel, but it is time for me to get out of the way. I'm joined today by Felix Shannon, and he has brought in an incredible interview with Michael Burge. I'm not going to say any more. Felix, take it away.
Michael Burge is an Australian journalist, author and artist who lives at Deepwater on Ngarrabal country in the New England region of New South Wales. And Michael joins us on the show today with his debut crime novel, Tankwater. And we're also going to touch a bit on his nonfiction memoir, Questionable Deeds. Michael, welcome to Final Draft. It's so good to have you.
Thanks, Felix. Wonderful to be on.
It is a little bit suspicious of me to have you on as my first guest on Final Draft. I'm well known around the book spheres here at 2SER, but it's the first time that Andrew Popel has ever been brave enough to hand me the reins and say, this is yours, go for it.
Well, I'm very, very honoured that I'm your first guest. I think that's marvellous. And what career advancement. It's always fantastic. Good on you.
Thank you. So in Tankwater, journalist and outback escapee James Brandt returns to his hometown of Kippen in rural New South Wales for the funeral of his older cousin, Tony. Tony's body was left abandoned for weeks after he died, and his will plants the entire family estate on James's shoulders. Memories from Tony's wedding 20 years ago rhyme with the preparations for his funeral, and James is the only one who seems to be hearing the patterns. Join us as we discuss Michael Burge's Tankwater. First of all, Michael, I wanted to ask for us City Slickers, what is Tankwater?
Well, Tankwater is, you have to catch it. You have to be very artful, usually on your roof or, in my case, where I live now in the northern New England region on Ngarrable country. We catch it on our shed roof and also every sort of square inch of corrugated iron that we have on top of buildings on our property goes into the gutter and runs down into a big, big tank. And it's been happening that way on in frontier communities across the world for a very, very long time. And, of course, you have to store it in something. And in Australia, we have this great tradition, as you probably know, of the corrugated iron tank. And there are many, many myths about tank water. One of the most common ones, which may well be true, but they say if you grow up in tank water, you can pretty much drink water anywhere in the world because you're drinking lots of stuff that isn't originally water, like, you know, mouse bodies and dead possums and, you know, all sorts of stuff goes into the tank. And you hope that it doesn't, but invariably it does. And I think they need cleaning out fairly often. Well, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, cleaning out is kind of what James Brandt does in this novel, come back to a hometown that
he does,
as his therapist kind of says, hasn't changed enough to where it'll feel different. He has to focus on how it is now rather than how he remembers it.
That's correct.
Yes. The thing I wanted to touch on there is how that connects with the title and his journey of seeing what was in the water the entire time.
Well, yes, so I guess if you were to compare the qualities of water between properties, you'd find all sorts of stuff lurking in the bottom of your water tank. And yes, it can get quite murky. And you're right, James turns up really at the threshold of his youth, long after it is gone. He's in his mid-30s. I think in some ways I was conscious of this as I wrote it. He really turns up at the threshold of his closet. It's kind of he's kind of expected to return into it when he comes back to the country because he may well be out in his life in the city, but back at home in the country, he's certainly not out, and a long way from being proud about it. Most of his relatives don't know. The ones that do only hint at it, like his cousin, Yvonne. And, he's got a lot of baggage to sort of sift through. It's no wonder that he left because there was probably too much to carry with him. The motif of water, particularly this tank water, this question about its quality is a good one to ask. They say if you've been on tank water as a kid, as I said, you can drink just about anything, but it's a bitter cup for James returning back to Kippen.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about his going back into the closet is that you mentioned, I think at Terra Australis Festival, when we first spoke about how coming out was what kind of pushed you into journalism and a search for the truth. And I really liked how at various tipping points, moments of regret or epiphanies through the story, James kind of marks them by trying to get a snazzy headline for them. Is that a healthy habit for him?
That's a really, really interesting question. Look, the headlines that James thinks up in his anxious state are kind of like a shorthand way to get to grips with how he feels and also for the reader. The old maxim about really great headlines and subheadings is that they're pretty much dad jokes and puns. For James, whenever you see one of his headlines, you're going to know right off the bat that he's not feeling great about himself and he doesn't particularly know how to chart his way through those moments. And I often get asked, writing a book about such dark subject matter, being the gay hate crimes theme of the book, were you concerned about content that is being published in this book? People often ask you that when you have a book coming out, are you concerned? And I have to say, I wasn't. But then I thought of one that I was concerned about and is one of the headlines. I just thought, gosh, how will people take that, particularly people in the country? And I haven't had any pushback about it, but it still worries away at my sub-editorial mind, for sure, because it's very descriptive, this one.
I felt that the question in this novel, compared to the mysteries that I normally read, was less who done it, how and why, and more, why was this allowed to happen? And one of the big tensions in the novel is, of course, James's father is one of the town's top cops at the time of the various deaths in the story.
Yes.
Did James ever expect he'd get a satisfying answer to why was this allowed to happen?
Yeah, that is also a really good question. I've not been asked that one before, but what you're asking, it goes right to the core of how does a really good thriller or a crime story or even a good old whodunit work? And having a journalist like James be the one seeking the truth, journalists were often only just one shade away, one degree away from what you'd call police procedural processes. We, as journalists, if you're working on the crime rounds in the suburbs or in the city or in country towns, the further away from metro areas you get classically, the more you're going to be involved in crime reporting. But there's an old standard in weekly newspapers that you go around and see the police or you give them a call and you get the police rounds. Every newspaper has a kind of a different approach or focus to this. There are some editors that say we want our readers to know every single time there's a house fire. We want to know every single time there's a car accident when there's people trapped. And if you've read the Shipping News or any of your listeners have, you'll remember there were very clear priorities for Coyle when he started the job of reporting on that Newfoundland newspaper about, you know, blood and gore and that sort of thing. Those were the priorities. So it's a question, journalists, I encourage you to ask if you're going for a job in a country newspaper or a suburban newspaper, ask what the priorities are, because in police and emergency rounds, that's kind of what you'll be getting out of bed to go and report on.
Well, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing there is that that relates a lot to crime and crime thriller writing and how we present the grim parts of society.
Yeah.
And I've been circling this idea of like flavors of the page turner, you know, the page turner being the core tenet of the thriller novel. And the odd thing about Tankwater in an enjoyable way was that I felt the flavor of the page turner here was a sense of discomfort. The idea that everything there was like, oh gosh, if people would just open up to each other, if people would be honest to each other, if people didn't see each other this way, then the tension here would just be released. So I was just turning the page, just hoping like someone would say something good for the first time in a long while. And those moments do come and they're really great when they do through the novel. How enveloping do you think that sense of tension is for James? And how did it evolve more than he thought it did between 1985 and 2005?
Discomfort is a really fantastic word to use in describing it. And you know what? I actually encountered a bit of discomfort this weekend just gone, going to a Christmas party in the country, here in a country town. And gosh, it took me by surprise how, you know, I'm 51 years old. I'm out. I say to myself that I'm proud, but I still experience those discomforts that I've recreated for James. And you know, here we are in 2021. James was in 2005 back in his country town and then in 1985 as a kid. And in some aspects, you can still have your knees cut off a bit by these, I suppose, they're community expectations. And I think probably in the country, I can say this because I'm from here and I live in the country now, is that the expectation to be genteel, be polite is greater. It just took me by surprise this week that here, just those 15 or 16 years beyond the timing of Tankwater, that they're still around. And it's not a big thing, but it doesn't take long for discomfort to turn into something nastier. And
yeah.
And for a thriller, a crime story, that's always the need, I think, to get that page-turning quality. And boy, was it fun, I think, to actually, in that story, to actually create situations where gentility goes out the window.
Yeah.
Or that characters need to actually keep themselves nice, because it does create tension. And the scene I'm thinking about in Tankwater is the wedding scene where James's parents, who are estranged, they're separated, and they are expected to dance, and they kind of they engage in that process. It's on the surface all looking wow, you know, I'm sure that, you know, parents observing that and children would possibly have thought, well, maybe they'll get back together.
Yeah.
But there's just no way that's going to happen.
Mm.
But no one can state that clearly. So it is very discomforting. And that's such a great term, Felix, to use for those moments.
Well, yeah, there are two things that I want to touch on. The first one is just like a positive note to flip over that previous question, which was at the bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival a couple of weeks ago, at least as we record. This episode will be coming out a bit later. Someone asked a wonderful question about how that discomfort has effectively evolved in rural communities.
Mm.
And your answer, I thought, was really beautiful, talking about how it's better to come out in rural communities now because the community knows to stand behind you at that point.
Yes.
What is your kind of hope for that acceptance growing in our regional communities? And what do you think is often missed by people in the city when we look at that relationship further out in the country?
Oh, look, that's such a big, hopeful potential for hope in that question.
Yeah.
And look, if you'd asked me 30 years, 40 years ago, how far I think things would go for LGBTIQA plus in this country, and particularly in country towns, I never would envisage that it had gone as far as it has in terms of equalities and freedoms and protections. So with this answer, I have to really pull out the stops, because we're looking at the future. So let's imagine 30 years from now that there's no cause for people to leave unless they want to. So now in 2021, I could remember or tell your listeners a few different social situations I've been in here in the country when it's very, very clear that just by being visible that me and my husband are making a difference. It can be difficult because there are many, many people who are at different stages with this.
Well, yeah, the thing I was going to raise, right, is that people are being at different stages of understanding, is that the last time we spoke before the Sydney Crime Writers Festival, you essentially grilled me about my queer identity.
Yes.
And I found it really interesting reading Questionable Deeds after that discussion, because you talk about how queer folk are often asked to justify and explain who they are. And
yes,
it was so bizarre thinking about it in that conversation, because I was like, but Michael did that to me.
You did. We're very kindly responded to my grilling. And and I hasten to add to, for your listeners' sake, I did give you an out. You were.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm not trying to throw you under the bus here. I just thought that it was really interesting that, like, you know, that discussion has gone from feeling so defensive to more about just expressing at least who I am.
Yes.
You know, I felt like you having that conversation, you doing the grilling, means that you're not as confronted by the idea of having to defend yourself.
That's absolutely correct. And yes, Questionable Deeds is now, the writing of it is now 7 years ago, and the time period I was writing about was 2004, 2005. So it shows you how quickly things are changing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's, look, being a journalist, I suppose I just gave you what I'd call a classic interview and said, you know, you're allowed to say this is all off the record, but, you know, but you were very kind, very understanding. And yeah, it was a great gift that you gave me, because of some inspiration I'd had earlier that day about another character I'm writing in the next thing that I may well have complete in manuscript form. I was grappling with the concept of bisexuality. Yes. And yes, the point we were trying to make is that people are at different stages with all of this. And you know, yeah, the alphabet soup is getting bigger. As I warn people, there's going to be a lot more letters of the alphabet, I think. So when you asked me earlier to project about the future, one thing I hope is that we'll eventually just get to H for human and be done with
right.
That would be really, really wonderful.
Oh, gosh. Now that's bliss you've described right there. Yeah. I guess I wanted to take a dive back into the grimier side of Tank Water and Questionable Deeds. You mentioned in Questionable Deeds an obstacle course, you know, of Beats, older men, and this sense of directionlessness that there is in early sexual experiences, or at least there definitely was for many young gay men. In Tank Water, that manifests as the toilets near the Kippen Bridge, the young James's obsession with Tony. Why was it important for you to show that even though there is a kind of dirty sense to this, that it's still part of the experience? You know, why was it important not to sanitize that?
Oh, gosh. Such big questions. These are great. I have to preface all my answers to this particular issue with a genuine non-judgmental approach that I take to people's pathway to consensual intimacy. And beat culture is something which I think it's joked about a lot, but not actually either analyzed or written about or portrayed in a way that people can understand or that's somehow accessible for all audiences to see or read or understand. I never had a question with Tank Water about would I write those scenes in. Never had a question. Yeah. They had to be there. But I certainly pondered and took some very, very long walks about including that content in Questionable Deeds, because Questionable Deeds is a memoir. This is my life that I'm talking about and the lives of others. But I needed to write a very truthful account of some really bad deeds that were going on at every level. So I could have written with Questionable Deeds a real misery memoir and played the violin for myself. But I thought, no, hang on. As a grieving spouse from a solid de facto relationship that was monogamous, I ended up coming face to face with my demons, and I was part of beat culture. I was going to beat, seeking out that consensual intimacy. And I thought, well, I've got a choice here. I can either paint myself as some kind of saint amongst sinners, but I think that's a very dangerous thing when you're writing nonfiction. I think that's where the idea of the misery memoir comes from. And so I actually, as you know, I wrote about that culture in Questionable Deeds as a means of, I suppose, equalizing the playing field. Most kinds of responses I get to beat culture in my writing is that people can't quite believe that it's going on. Like, is it really happening in
our
town?
I'll confess I didn't know a thing about it until I read either of these books. Like, I had to research it to even understand entirely what was going on. I guess the kind of last topic that I wanted to wrangle with in this book is the sense of adventure that goes on through it. Because obviously, given the subject matter that we've been speaking about, the book is heavy, but it's still a coming-of-age story, and intrinsic to that is finding yourself, and accompanying that is the journeys that you go on to get there. How did you feel about putting in these small facets of joy the whole way through the story, be it, you know, just experiences going out on the farm and doing work between James and Tony when he first gets back into town, be it more broad experiences dealing with the relationship between Dylan and James in 2005? And I guess the weirdest one that I wanted to ask you about is, for example, we see James, you know, text himself notes in 2005. And the preface question I guess I have for that is, was he a BlackBerry user, or was he like frantically mashing the number keys to get these notes in time after being chased into Tony's apartment?
You know what? On that issue, I actually had help from the book formatter Zena Shapter, who's a fantastic book formatter and does a lot of Midnight Sun's work. And I was just honest with Zena. I said, I can't quite work out how to do this. And she said, remember before we had these amazing smartphones, you could actually send a text to yourself. And I thought, oh, of course. I had done that on many occasions. And so, that was really wonderful support from someone who remembered the same technology of the day. And that's priceless when you're working with a team who's putting a book together. But your question also was about the lighter moments in the story. And to be honest, I was really conscious of putting those in. I was asked recently about at the Terra Australis panel session of LGBTQ authors about whether I had been aware of any kind of gay heroes or characters when I was young. And I really thought, oh, gosh, actually, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
But what I did have were cartoon characters. And one of the most memorable for me was, of course, Snagglepuss, who was outed years ago as being a wonderful gay panther or whatever creature he is. I remembered how those kind of characters, they gave me a kind of a shtick, which I evolved into a bit of a protection mechanism, particularly at school.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the lighter moments in Tank Water are an overhang of that, a kind of a sardonic way of that James steps back and looks at situations and it's just like, for God's sake, you know, that's quite funny. Like the way that the the young receptionist at the motel is really not listening to him when he's checking out, and he just, you know, makes that classic joke, it was a terrible stay, thank you very much, and she doesn't hear him at all. I took a leaf out of Leanne Moriarty's Big Little Lies, because she uses some fantastic devices in that book to do something very, very similar. It's a wonderful shorthand, and I think readers these days expect a little bit of that from authors, and I don't mind. I think as a journalist, we need to do that as well, like subheadings in the article. You know, these days you get all, I call them bells and whistles. You get like asked a poll halfway through an article, or you get to look at a map, or you know, it's a little bit like that. I think that I enjoyed creating Tank Water being just a little bit like a really, really long form article in that sense.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on Final Draft. It has been a heavy conversation, but one I'm glad we've had, and a book that I'm very glad that I got the chance to read. I super appreciate you taking the time out of your week to sit down and speak with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much, Felix, and to 2SER.
You're most welcome. Michael Burgess' Tank Water is out with Midnight Sun Publishing, as well as his self-published memoir, Questionable Deeds, which has been reprinted alongside this. And I would highly recommend checking the both of them out. We'll have links up on Final Draft's podcast, of course.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me here on Final Draft. It's been a pleasure. And back to you.
Thank you very much, Felix, and thank you also to Michael Burge, who joined us on the show today with his debut novel, Tank Water. Felix Shannon can be found every Sunday night on Death of the Reader. It is so great to have him here, and of course, an extended cut of that interview will be going up on the podcast. You will be able to find links on our socials, and it's time for me to say goodbye. A nice, easy episode for me today. Thank you again, Felix Shannon. Give him a clap. I'm going to leave you with a track from Moaning Lisa. Moaning Lisa are a Melbourne band. They released their debut album in 2021, and this is something terrific from that. It is Cold Water. I am Andrew Popel. I'll be back next week with more Final Draft. Bye now.
Too much of my childhood pleasing people who didn't listen to me.